Welcome to the Principles of Performance podcast, where we discuss how to optimize your health, fitness, and performance. Drawing on decades of experience of working as coaches, consultants, and trainers to top performers, athletes, and teams from professional sports to top universities to the U.S. military, Eric DeGatti and Mike Perry discuss topics and strategies of how to perform at your highest level and be your very best. Join us and our friends and colleagues who are leaders in the fitness and performance industry as we investigate and challenge the most popular training, nutrition, lifestyle, and recovery protocols. Away we go. Here we are with the Principles of Performance podcast. I'm your host, Eric DeGatti, along with my friend and co-host, Mike Perry. And we got another one of your Massachusetts buddies with us today, Perry.
Yeah, it's Team Massachusetts. We've got an old friend of mine, Scott. And I met Scott at, it was my second or third job up in Woburn at Athletic Evolution. And he was an athlete at the time. He was actually training. He was at UMass. We're just finishing up at UMass. And I remember him, first of all, the guy was an absolute savage. In the weight room had traps that were bigger than his head. And he was one of those guys that was just always in there, but he was a bright, bright kid. And he evolved into, a really, really seasoned strength coach. And it's been cool to watch his journey over the years at AE. And I'm excited to have him on. It's a lot of fun to connect with some old friends. So I'm going to let Eric finish up with the bio, but this is going to be a good one.
All right. So Scott Duggan's a strength and conditioning coach who's currently serves as director of operations at Athletic Evolution in Massachusetts. Prior to joining AE, he led the Assumption College football summer strength and conditioning program and is a former captain of Hudson High School's football and ice hockey teams and graduated, as Mike alluded to, from UMass at Amherst with a degree in kinesiology. And he was a fullback when he was there, and he was special teams player of the year in 2010. And he's worked with every type of athlete from youth to pros, including running NFL and NBA combine programs each winter and spring, where him and his team has helped over 50 athletes sign NFL contracts and 4 athletes get drafted. In the fall of 2020, Scott was tasked with starting the Bentley University Strength and Conditioning Program, a great school. He continues to work daily with the head strength and conditioning coach at Bentley on the day-to-day operations of the program. And more recently, Scott has also gotten heavily involved in injury prevention and rehab. And this is the thrust of our talk today. He takes pride in helping athletes come back from major injuries stronger and better than before their injury. And over the last 10 years, he's helped over 80 athletes return to their sport following ACL surgery. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Mike, I'll let you kick it off with the first question.
Yeah, Scott. Well, first of all, it's good to have you on here, buddy. How's everything going these days?
It's great, man. Can't complain. I work in gym clothes in a gym. And so, now that my kids are older, they're actually starting to come in here a couple hours a day with me, as I see with your kids as they get older. And so, things are going good. Can't complain.
Awesome. Awesome. So let's dive right in. So as a strength and conditioning coach, how did you settle into the niche of helping athletes that have had ACL injuries return to play?
Yeah, well, I know most people who get into this get through it through an injury themselves. And so for me, I'm very thankful. I've been pretty healthy my whole athletic career. I probably first started getting into evaluating injuries and working in rehabilitation settings at UMass through the kinesiology program. You have to take classes with the athletic trainer centered around athletic training and evaluating athletes and testing. And then I spent a semester in the athletic training room. And since I was working with football, we're not allowed to work with football, but I worked with men's and women's lacrosse at the time. And so a lot of it is, taping ankles and, all that general stuff. But I was able to see some ACL return to sport rehab through the athletic trainer there and started to really kind of be intrigued by it. Then when I got to Athletic Evolution in Woburn, as you mentioned, if you remember, we had Mark Baldwin in Sports and Physical Therapy Associates in there. And I had a bunch of free time. And so I would volunteer and intern with Mark. And I did that for 6 months to a year. And a few months in, we started having several ACL return to sport athletes or athletes coming off ACL surgery. And Mark kind of took me through early stage ACL return to sport in the physical therapy setting. And then these athletes got cut off from their health insurance and were anywhere from 4 to 7 months post-surgery, and which you've come to find out is very early on in the return to sport process that we'll get into, you know, later on in the discussion. And so what he did was, because I was working on Athletic Evolution, he helped kind of the segue of them, you know, working with me and one-on-one. And it started out by him doing the evaluation and helping me with the programming, and then eventually talking about it and letting me make adjustments, and then so forth, starting to do my own thing. And then about a couple years into kind of that relationship, Mark went and started his own physical therapy practice. And so we lost Mark. And I was fortunate enough, the McKaylee Center for Injury Prevention, which has been open in Waltham for about a decade, I believe, started by Lyle McKaylee, who's kind of at the forefront of, you know, ACL surgery. They initially started it to kind of gather a bunch of data on ACL surgery and how those athletes return to sport. And so they were evaluating them at a very high level and doing it much more in the return to sport evaluations we see today, as opposed to all of the evaluations I had seen had come from orthos, and not all those are created equally. And so I started to get a steady stream from them, and I was using their testing and their evaluation to do programs and kind of sending it back. And then around 2018, we decided to open our own physical therapy clinic, which I own and operates out of our facility here in Wilmington now since we moved. And I was fortunate enough to hire Dr. Julie Hubbard, who has since moved on and started her own place called the ACL, called the Return to Sport Institute. And that's located, I believe, in Framingham. And she had had 4 ACL surgeries. She had started a blog on ACL rehab, and obviously being a physical therapist and a doctor herself, she had developed her own testing protocols. And that is what I have come to adapt and use in our physical therapy clinic. And it was passed down to our current physical therapists and clinic director who are still there. And we use that, or a couple of variations or iterations off of that test that Julie brought to us, as our now our own ACL return to sport test. I'll always welcome any other testing, but it's nice to be able to do your own in-house testing regularly. And that is really, really, that is really where my programming and everything changed, because when you're relying on evaluation and testing every, you know, couple months, 3 months, when they're going back up for their 3 month and their 6 month and their 9 month checkup, we do for every 3 to 4 weeks, we'll do muscle testing in here. And what I found is that not all people are created equal. And so, you know, what works for ACL return to sport athlete A does not work for ACL return to sport athlete B. And so testing is very, very important. And so now I rely on Maureen, who's my clinic director. And she's a former college AT. And so she does all our evaluating and testing in-house, and we collaborate and work together. And then Shannon, who's our lead physical therapist, and the other physical therapist. Now I kind of have my own transition. And so if they're doing physical therapy with them, you know, 4 to 6 months, I'll start to take them. And it's a very easy transition because I've already had connections with them throughout their rehabilitation process. And so how I've looked at ACL return to sport and how I got into it has slowly evolved. And I think just like anything in strength and conditioning, because we can't do human testing, it should continue to evolve as we get more and more information on it. And so, you know, I think that's why I really am drawn to it, is that I learn something new every single day that I train someone, and every single client that I have and every person I talk to and colleague in the return to sport field, it really stimulates my brain. You know, as opposed to, let's call it summer football strength and conditioning, which I've done, you know, my entire life. You know, and so it's very interesting to me, and I always enjoy talking about it.
All right. So there's a bunch of stuff that you talked about that I want to circle back to, but let's start from the slant of the strength coach and where we play a role in this whole process. And the first part of that is we have to gain the trust of the medical professionals and the clinicians involved. So talk a little bit about how you gain that trust to let them allow you to be part of that decision-making process.
Yeah. And so I would say it's very similar to how we gain trust as a strength and conditioning coach, whether it's a college setting or whether it's, you know, employees for someone in their own facility, like Mike's facility is employees underneath them, you know, communication and connectivity. And so making sure you're networking and branching out and then proving yourself, right? And so I don't think anyone just meets with me and talks with me for 15 minutes and goes, all right, cool, you know, like, you know, good to go, you know, I'll start sending all my people there. But most of my stuff comes from, okay, the McKaylee Center sends me some people and they do some evaluation. And then when they go back there, those people improve and they progress and they get discharged. So now McKaylee Center wants to send me more and more people. Athletic trainers, right? In my communication with them back and forth for when the athlete's returning to sport and what they've been through and sharing testing numbers and showing how that athlete has progressed. Now that I have my own physical therapy clinic, it's a little bit easier because we network with doctors a lot more, you know, at an early stage. And so building their trust in trust of the therapist within my own clinic was probably a little bit easier because we're dealing with them day to day. But before then, I really had to go out. I, you know, spent a lot of time going out, networking, meeting with doctors, going out, making sure you're sharing as much information with them. And then once they kind of see, you know, the good thing is when you're testing, you can see the results and you can see the athlete improve. And if someone's doing that, you'll start to get buy-in. And I take that same approach with my athletes and the parents who trust me to train their kids is you've got to show them something in terms of where is their improvement? How are they doing this? What can you do to make them better? And then you gain that trust over time.
Okay, so now you have all these different people that are involved in this process, from the surgeon down to the rehab people, down to us in the weight room. And there has to be some sort of decision tree because it can get fuzzy, right? It's not black or white of who's handling what and who and how we handling this. And I know for myself, and I, when I owned my facility, we were a multidisciplinary center. Okay, well, what is under your umbrella, what's under mine? So we take the egos and we out of it, and we can work all say within our scope of practice. Talk a little bit about that decision tree of how, okay, you're going to handle this, I'm going to handle this, let's meet back in the middle here.
Yeah. So in a perfect world, now that we have our own physical therapy clinic, I have my athletes in our facility the entire time. They're going into the PT clinic before surgery and doing some training. They're going into the PT clinic immediately afterwards. And then what I will do is I will follow up on care throughout the entire time they're in the physical therapy clinic, communicating back and forth with the therapist, but that is their realm. And so I let them handle the care throughout that entire period, but I'm staying up to date and I'm very aware of kind of the timetables and things we want to hit. Because to me in ACL rehab, it's not a finite amount of time. It's not a linear progression like we do in a health with a healthy athlete or a healthy team. It's checkpoint systems, right? And so I can't go in and say, okay, well, at 3 months, you're going to be here. And at 4 months, you're going to be here. But if I'm keeping up to date on the checkpoints with my physical therapist and what they want to see, then we have a pretty good idea of when that transition process is going to take. And for me, sometimes insurance dictates that, right? Insurance cuts them off. They don't care that you're an athlete. Can you walk around pain-free? That's all I'm covering, right? Professional athletes get, you know, unlimited care. And so for some people, I have to see them early on than either I would expect or they would expect. Other people in a perfect world, it's, you know, 5, 6, 7 months. And so for there at that point, then I'm going to take over care. And at that point, I'm still keeping in touch with my physical therapist. And then when they're getting ready to return to sport, then I'm reaching out and I'm communicating with all the necessary parties. So I actually have an athlete right now, is around 9 months. I have had several conversations with people in her network. So the athletic trainer at her school, the individual skills coach that she's going to be working with, because I always like someone to do individual skills first. It's a controlled setting for their sports specific movements. And then their coach that they're going to go back to. And in a perfect world, the AT would manage their coach if it's at their school. And so for me, it's a passing on of who's the overall care. I try to keep in contact with them. And if they're in our PT clinic, it's very, very easy. For the athletes that don't go to our PT clinic, it can be more challenging, right? Because I found before I opened my own PT clinic in 2018, therapists were very able to communicate back and forth. It was easy. They trusted me. They worked back and forth. But then once I opened my PT clinic, some people look at us as competitors and overlapping. And so unfortunately, some of them either don't want to communicate properly or help form in kind of the transition. In terms of orthopedic surgeons and doctors, not all created equal. And so I have a couple in my network that we trust and we rely on very well. I have others that I've seen where they go in for a 6-month checkup, and we'll talk about timelines and numbers later, but they don't do any testing. And just because they're at 6 months, they clear them, which I have several data that says that's, you know, probably not what you want to be doing. And so for them, I kind of take them out of the equation. They're not gonna, be hands-on with the person. And so when I ask an athlete to come into my return to sport program, I usually ask them that, hey, listen, from now until when I connect you with your AT, I want to handle everything. And so that has to be communicated from them to the necessary parties. And I want to talk to them. And so it does get, as you're aware, like the more people you add, and when you start going outside of your network, that is probably one of the most challenging things. I know high school football coaches are probably the biggest detriment to ACL return to sport, because we need a progressive overload when they get back there. And so they are all or nothing. And so I've talked to football coaches like, well, I need them to do individual drills for a couple days, right? And then we monitor soreness, right, with the AT. And then I need them to take a day off. And then they're going to come back and they're going to work a little bit more the next time. And then they can do team drills, but they're in a non-contact jersey. And then they can do contact, but X amount of time. And the coaches just go, well, when they can do everything, they can do everything. Or if they don't, they stand on the side. And that's just not how it works. I like to take that approach in the PT clinic, in the weight room, and then also when they get out into their sport, there needs to be progressive overload throughout, or the athlete breaks down and gets hurt. And so this is by far to me, Eric, the most challenging thing I face if it's outside of our network.
And that's not just ACLs. Like, the same progression should go for your hamstring injury, right? It should be, you know, in terms of that progressive overload. Now, Mike, before you jump to the next question, you brought up timelines a couple times, Scott. And ironically, you know, because our phones are creepy and they listen to us, when I was doing the notes for our show, I was scrolling through and this study came up. It was from 2020. And the stats show that you're 7 times more likely to re-tear your ACL if you go back to sport prior to 9 months post-op.
Yep. Right. And so you see, obviously, when you talk about interpreting data, right, there's a million different studies, but when there's a lot centered around the same thing, that's what I look at. And I've seen some, I have some, every month up until 9 months, you're 50% less likely to tear your ACL. So that means if you come back 6 months as opposed to 9 months, you could be as high as 150%. And so 24% of amateur athletes don't return to sport till 1 year, right? Do you ever hear that? Like, I never, you hear about the NFL guy who returned in 6 months. I hear doctors clearing people at 6 months. Does anyone go at the beginning, hey, just so you're aware, only 24% of amateur athletes come back before a year. So now all these athletes, right, they're already psychologically damaged from the surgery and time away from sport. Now you've set a timeline that is either going to make them greater risk for injury, or it's going to be a massive psychological letdown for them that they're not ready there. And so for me, I try very rarely. I mean, 9 months to me is like the bare minimum. Most of my athletes are 9 to 12 months or greater, and they obviously have to pass a battery of tests to do so. And so if you don't pass a return to sport battery of tests, you are as much as 86% more likely, or you're 86% less likely if you pass a return to sport battery of tests. And so to me, that timeline of 9 to 12 months, as well as return to sport testing, are probably the two most important factors to me that I look at for getting an athlete, when you're talking overarching items, to get back to sport.
All right. So let's talk about sort of the typical ACL rehab plans or cases that we see. Give us two of the biggest, in your eyes, the two of the biggest shortcomings that you see in traditional ACL rehab return to play programs.
So in terms of like someone programming it and missing it.
Yeah, like- exactly. Just like if you see like there's two key things that most people are missing. It could be program. It could be load. It could be, I mean, you name it. What do you think it would be?
So I think if you're just talking about the general strength and conditioning coach, right, it's factoring in the graph site. And so like the graph site is so, so important, right? Obviously you want to go to a doctor. Like if a doctor does quad tendon grafts, like you don't want to say, oh, I need this graph, but factoring that in. And so I tell people, like, if you're a basketball player and you're getting a patella tendon graft, well, you better expect when you start jumping that you're going to get patella tendonitis, right? And so especially early on in knee dominant exercises and return to run, that is going to be a limiting factor in how we train them. And so we can just do a bunch of concentric knee dominant exercises and all of a sudden I get patella tendonitis 2 weeks in and I've got to take 3 to 4 weeks off or go back to physical therapy, or I can factor that into my training already. And so I do a lot of almost triphasic training, especially early on, isometric stuff with my athletes. I do a lot of BFR, so we can do submaximal loads in terms of our knee dominant movements if we were using either a patella tendon or a quad tendon. If I use a hamstring graft, then I need to make sure I strengthen that hamstring because I know automatically off the bat, I'm going to have a hamstring deficit right to left. And then now I'm susceptible to hamstring strain, scar tissue in my hamstring. And then we all know like hamstrings are the brakes. Hamstring to quad ratio is very important. And so if I'm already starting out with a deficit in my hamstring, then I've got a long way to go because how important that hamstring is. And so making sure you're just understanding that it's not just the ACL graft itself. It's like, where did we get that graft from and how does that factor in? If we used an allograft as opposed to an autograft, like I tell you, under the age of 40 in an athlete, like you made a mistake already because you don't know where that came from or how old that person was or, you know, the integrity of it. You want to take it from someone who's similar body weight yourself and does the same athletic demands. And so I would say right off the bat, that's probably the number one factor for me. I also would look at training beforehand. And so like, for me, it's very important that an athlete does physical therapy or strength training. There's significant, you come out on the other side of things significantly better if you can do that. And so if I can get with an athlete, so like, let's say, I'm over at Bentley and one of their athletes tore their ACL, I'm going to know about it very quickly. Or if it's a team we've worked with and it was either someone in that team or a connection to that team, hey, they tore their ACL, we might be able to get a hold of them before surgery. And so if we do that, we can talk them through all of these, inform them on what they need to do, and maybe do 3 or 4 weeks of physical therapy, strength training before they did that, if they don't have, you know, say that base going on for sure. But I look at graft site for sure.
So you talk a whole lot about your testing and assessment process. Give us a quick like 10,000 foot view of what it looks like upon initially starting up and transitioning into your hands from rehab and when they start weight bearing, and then what it looks like when you green light them to go back on the field.
Yeah. And so our initial testing is range of motion and strength. And so for strength, we use a handheld dynamometer. We use a MicroFET 2 from Hogan Systems. And so has about a 1% error. And so, you know, it's not a Biodex, but it allows us to test regularly inside of our facility. And so we look at hip and knee strength. And so we're looking at flexion extension. And then that's going to tell us, obviously, bilaterally deficiencies. So if they had surgery on their left leg, what's their deficiency compared to their right for both their quad and their hamstring? We're also going to look at hamstring to quad ratio because we talked about how important that is and the breaks and the relationship between the hamstring and the quad there. We're going to look at range of motion in the ankle, knee and hip. And so there's a certain range of motion I want to see. If I don't, then they should continue in the physical therapy setting, at least in conjunction with that, until that range of motion is reached in terms of flexion, extension, the hips, you know, obviously ankle dorsiflexion, very, very important. I want to see at least 10 to 15 degrees. If it's below that and your ankle stops moving, then the stress goes to your knee. And so you need to have good ankle range of motion. If they're in balance right to left with ankle dorsiflexion, then we're going to look at, well, did you have an ankle injury? And is that something that obviously needs to be accounted for? And then from those strength numbers, the big one that I look at is relative to body weight strength. And so if you think about, we use a formula, we take the moment arm, basically from the center of the patella to where we put the middle of the dynamometer. We take the force in newtons that they produce either through the leg extension or the leg curl. And we times that together, the distances in meters, and then we divide that by their weight in kilograms. And so that gives us a number and a range that we're looking for. And so for hamstring relative to body weight, we're looking for 1.5 to 1.6 newtons to meters to kilograms. And for quad, we're looking for 3.0 to 3.2. And so it, they can be, and what we found with this is you can be symmetrical, which is great. But if you're not strong relative to your body weight, then that does you no good either, right? And so I've had athletes, okay, 135-pound female soccer player, a 275-pound defensive tackle football player, and they're both symmetrical. But when you look at their force and newtons produced in the same test, they're similar. And so when we plug that into our formula with their body weight, one of them is hits the numbers and the other is significantly lower than that because they're not strong relative to their body weight. And so that tells me kind of the initial phase of what I want to get out of it. I want to make sure I address imbalances. I really want to get them stronger like any strength coach would. And I want to address any mobility concerns kind of right away. And so that's what we're trying to get out of our initial test. I then muscle test them regularly every 3 to 5 weeks. And so what that tells me is, was what I was doing with them, is that getting the desired purpose? And so for instance, as strength and conditioning coaches, we do a lot of closed chained exercises, right? Because they're multi-joint, they're much more practical for our athletes, right? And so we're doing a squat or a squat variation where our foot is fixed and we're using multiple joints. Well, what that does to someone who's injured is the brain remembers that injury and it says, I don't wanna use that, right? So it compensates. And so with closed chain exercises, what you find when you retest is a lot of these athletes continue to compensate, even if they're unilateral exercises or split squat variations. And so we have to do a lot of open chain exercises and go back to bodybuilding, and do a lot of open chain stuff with our athletes early on until we address those imbalances, and then we can move forward. Once we move forward, though, I always continue to retest, and I'll do this throughout. So I have college athletes that cleared, return to sport, go back to college. I don't see them for 9 months. They come back in the summer. I'll re-muscle test them because I know when they go back, they go right back into bilateral, heavy, gross motor movements, and those imbalances start to come back. And so then I readdress them when I get them in the summer. And then the final return to sport evaluation, we take that testing and then we add in our jumping, our hopping, our change of direction, our return to run assessment. And that's kind of the last piece of the puzzle before we clear them. And that would be our final return to sport evaluation.
Hey, everybody, a quick break in the action here. Hope you're enjoying the show and we appreciate you listening. We're working hard to bring you the highest quality content and best guests every single week. So if you could do us a big favor and go and like and subscribe to the show on whatever platform you get your podcasts on, it would be greatly appreciated. Be sure to listen at the end of the show also to find out more information about our courses, as well as a special discount code for all our listeners. Thanks again, and let's get back to the show. Well, and that's kind of where I was going next, is because strength and conditioning is strength and conditioning, just by even virtue of the name, is traditionally biased towards strength, and we want to look at strength, but we have to look at a whole lot of other factors, from movement competency to motor control, the balance, to deceleration, reactivity, being able to do it. There's a whole nother patterning that happens when you have to do it reactively. So talk about how you kind of build that into the programming once you've kind of ticked the box that we're getting there with strength.
Well, I'll tell you can never go wrong getting people stronger. So it's never a bad place to start. But I always try to do, I basically call it strength and then movement, right? Or resistance training and then movement. movement. And so, you know, all the stuff you mentioned, you know, jumping, running, force absorption, motor control, balance, like to me would fall a little bit in kind of that movement category. And so as we're hitting our strength progressions and as we're going towards return to sport, I basically take all of that movement and I kind of program it. I like to call it starting with middle school training and progressing them to practical training. And we do it all on steroids. And so what I mean by that is we go through years and years of training in just a few weeks. And we follow kind of how ACL return sport started with the Moon ACL rehab protocol, which is a checkpoint-based system. And so I start with force absorption. It kind of falls under all of those things. And so jumping and returning to running, I teach my, even if it's a 23-year-old Division I college athlete, former All-American, you're starting with snap downs, middle school variation, learn, repattern your motor control. I want no valgus. I want your knee over your foot. Then we go to a hop with a stick and then a mini bounce and a continuous, then multi-planar movements going back and forth, then reactive base, then chain, then sports specific, and then sports specific in a controlled and uncontrolled setting. And so there's a checkpoint progression for all of those going forward. The jumping, hopping, and running, we would evaluate in the test of the final return to sport, but I'm evaluating my athlete every single day that I see them, both visually through what I see and then verbally through checking in with them, because obviously we could have done something before. And if they had a patella graft and they felt great during the workout, but then 24 hours later, they have patella tendonitis, well, maybe we introduced something too fast, or maybe we went a little bit faster than we would have liked. And so for me, all of that stuff should be done basically simultaneously. You know, I'll start doing snap downs a couple weeks into seeing them, even if they have a strength and balance, to start to prep them. Because what I don't want to happen is, okay, great, you cleared. Now we haven't done any running, jumping, change of direction, any of that stuff, which you probably wouldn't clear anyways. But now I got to spend months reintroducing that, or you're not going to have the motor control or the technique to be able to prevent you. Just because you're strong enough, if you're used to your knee constantly going in valgus and you valgus and you pattern that, well, you could be strong as hell, but you're going to continue to do that.
So, Scott, how important is it that we understand not only the specific sport that an athlete plays, but their actual position?
So sport, I mean, obviously hockey as opposed to soccer, way less friction, impact, right? A lot more dangerous. I have a friend that tore his ACL twice on a hockey rink. I tell him that's, he's probably the only person who's ever done that, because, you know, it has to be usually an impact on the ice hockey rink. And so knowing what sport they do and then the position within it so that I can know the athletic demands of that sport. And so that's where, you know, we always talk about, I think sports specific training is like a very polarizing topic on the internet, like anything else, right? And so I think if you're looking at sports specific training as like, I'm teaching them lacrosse, like that's not what I do, but I need to look at the demands of that sport in that position. And I need to factor it into my training. And for me, it would be finding out the muscle groups and we train them strength wise, and then the movements, planes they move in, athletic demands that they do, and build it into the movement progression I talked about. So, you know, we're starting with basic plyometrics, but when we get to multi-planar and more advanced stuff, it's looking like the movements they would do in the sport. And then I find it very beneficial to find a skills coach for some of the more advanced sports like soccer and field hockey, lacrosse, that those are available. Because just like anything else, if I can have you work with someone in a controlled setting and environment and build that up, you're going to be better for it when you return into it, right? Like, I don't want the kid to dodge to lacrosse with your son. Like, I don't want a kid to have to focus on cradling and then dodge for the first time as a reactive component in a live game. Like, that's insane. And so for me, I would like to mimic that the best I can in my setting through some plyometrics and stuff. And then I'd like to get them for a few weeks with a skills coach who can control that. There's no contact. I always tell them the first couple of weeks, make it controlled. I want you to dodge on this cone, then make it reactive, then build them into small group training, then get them on the field, talk to the coach and say, hey, listen, non-contact, you know, for a few days, right? Then give them a couple of days off, see how they respond, then get them into group stuff, non-contact, then contact for a limited amount of time. And so that same approach, I think, should be factored into your training. And then also your goal of like, how do you want them to bridge from like the plyometric they did with you to the movement they have to do, the skill in their sport. And to me, that's like a lot of it is like, there's no, like, we don't take any class on that in kinesiology. Like, to me, that's a lot of talking to the people in that sport and like understanding, okay, like I didn't play lacrosse. So talk me through like, what do they need to do and visually see it? And now, well, if I do these in my plyometrics, is that something that would go into that? Okay. And then what do you want them to do here? And I've learned a lot from return to sport through different sports and researching it and talking to people and building stuff in there. But yeah, that's the sport. And then the position they play with it is important. There's all, you know, a bunch of other profile things you factor into.
Now, something that you just said that I want to go back and underline, because I think it's not just a deficit in return to sport training, but just in strength and conditioning in general, is that when I look at someone's program, whether it's a team asking me to kind of audit their program or look at someone's individual program where an athlete comes to me for additional help, and I'll literally sit with them and walk through their program and I'll say, okay, we move three directions, front and back, side to side, diagonally, rotational. I said, all right, let's walk through your program. And it's incline press, and it's deadlift, and it's squat, and it's split squat. And it's like, do you notice a theme here? Everything is front and back, but 99% of your time is going in those other directions. And that if we fail to address those, not only getting those multiple planes, but also getting in multiple positions, you're going to get in funky positions. Like you mentioned early on, you're going to coach no valgus, no knee inside the shoelaces type of stuff. But eventually at some point, it's part of our diligence to get them into those funky positions and planes. So talk a little bit about that. That's part of our responsibility. It's preparing them for that. So like you said, the first time they get in that position is in a controlled environment, not in a game.
Yeah. And that's hard. So I grew up, my dad owned two Gold's Gyms, was a power lifter. And so like my background was powerlifting. And then I went into football, and my football strength and conditioning coach had been there for 30 years and he was a shot putter. And so like this for me was something that came later on in life. Everything for me was exactly like you described, in squat and bench, and even like bench press to incline bench press to dumbbell incline, right? To single arm. It's like, dude, what are you doing? You know? And so, for me, I think one of the eye-opening things for me was when I was done playing sports, I did an internship. And then while I was doing Assumptions football in the summer, I did an internship with Mike Boyle's strength and conditioning. And obviously for him, and you know, a lot of functional movement and stuff kind of opened my eyes to exactly what you're saying. And then as I evolved, I started finding more people, you know, in functional training and doing things like that. And then eventually, you have to get creative and use your brain and have some critical thinking. And I've come up with some very good lunge variations. And I find landmine gets people into funky positions, but in a safe way, really good. And so I use landmines a lot when we're talking about like curtsy lunges or crossover lunges or 45 degree lunges or a rotational lunge. And so you can do a lot of these things. I think we, because of social media and judging people, everything has to be perfect, right? And so it's straight lines in here. But as you mentioned, sport is not that. And so there needs to be some variability to the training. There needs to be some free form running. I know Jeremy Frisch, who I believe Mike knows, like he's big into, you know, youth athletes and moving them in free form and, you know, moving different planes. And like, I've taken a lot of that into my middle school and high school and even my return to sport and, you know, doing some of those outside of the box things through following some people and then crossing over different demographics. And so I've learned some stuff from youth training that was very helpful that way. Other stuff is just, you know, creative thinking and, you know, making adjustments here and different things there. But for the lift, think of it this way. If I'm going to have them move in that plane or in that funky movement, the best way to prime them would be to do in a previous phase that in a strength. And so my like lateral lunge, right, is going to be done before I go into a lateral bound. And, you know, my 45 degree lunge is going to do before I go into my 45 degree bound. And so I can do some things to build that. And then the last phase is, you know, free form run and, you know, these funky different positions.
So there's a slide that we have, and Mike, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about when we present in for FMS, where we have a biomechanical model of I think it was a high school female athlete who tore her ACL, and you watch her squat, and as she goes down, the one knee just completely caves in, the whole leg caves in and comes back. And we ask the room, we say, okay, she tore her ACL, which one is it? And you got a 50-50 shot, right? Well, it's not the one that caves in and buckles. It's the other one, because what they looked at her was, is they looked at her as a, you know, she's the 6 p.m. knee patient, and they poked and prodded and iced and heated and stimmed and rubbed and stretched and strengthened and did everything in the world to her knee that was injured without realizing this is a movement problem that she's also got on the other side. And this was a non-contact thing. And unless you address this movement problem, she's going to have it again. And sure enough, this girl retore her ACL on the other side. And so talk about how the approach is going to be different, where if you have a non-contact injury that may be stemming from a deficit that was they kind of brought to that, as opposed to where, you know, I had a kid tears ACL where he's a running back, plants his foot, guy's holding onto it while a helmet smashes into his knee. You know, I told him, look, you just got to run faster. Like, don't let helmets go into your knee. So talk about how the approach is different for the non-contact where your body just fails you versus a traumatic event.
So for those who go through ACL surgery, it's about 1 in 5 then tear their contralateral ACL. And so for me, any non-contact, you have to assume that they were predisposed to that injury. And so if they're predisposed on one side, they're going to be predisposed on the other side. And so now all of your testing data is essentially going to be a lie, right? Because you're trying to get one leg to be symmetrical to another leg that's predisposed to the ACL injury. So how does that help you? And so that's why for us, we use relative to body weight strength, because in addition to symmetry, we want them to make sure they're there. I would say I'll always be on the lookout for it. I'd say you still want to rely on your testing. And so, you know, that's why testing regularly should always point you in the right direction. But anytime someone tells me non-contact, I immediately start thinking, hey, we need to train both sides and we can't just look at symmetry. And then if someone got an impact injury, it's not that I wouldn't rule it out completely, but now I'm just going to let the testing kind of dictate what they do.
So before you jump in, Mike, and not to put you on the spot here, Scott, but how much of that reoccurrence can we attribute just to shitty rehab?
I mean, anything that I did would probably be made up, obviously. But in terms of anecdotal, I'd say
I'm not looking for numbers, but like, could we look back and say, well, how much of that is just people are missing shit? Like they're just not doing a thorough job of doing the type of stuff you're doing.
Yeah, well, a study I read the other day was 86% of ACL rehab is low standard. And so that's very, very scary, obviously. And I'd say it's less about the programming and it's more about the current setup of our like health insurance and everything along the lines, because as we've gone over several times, 9 months, 1 year, either way for amateur athletes, this is a very long rehab. And not everyone comes and sees someone who understands the full scope of everything or goes to an orthopedic surgeon who says, hey, you've got to find a physical therapist, then also a return to sport when that shuts off and your AT needs to be involved. All of them need to communicate. Oh, by the way, if you're having psychological problems, you know, we should go see a sports psych, your coaches, and like we'll work all together. And so when you have that many people and there's no CEO or management up at the top, stuff is gonna get missed all the time. And then a lot of people don't have the resources to test. And so you go, if you do your strength and conditioning with your AT at a school, it just might be like they don't have a handheld dynamometer. They don't have access to certain equipment to be able to do certain things. If you're talking about just a general strength coach, I'd say they'll probably get the athlete strong, but they're not going to do the testing that's needed to readjust and reassess their program.
Gotcha. Man, well, you've covered a ton of information. And so is there anything that you have coming up in the future, Scott? Anything that we can look forward from you? Any more information? Any new endeavors? What do you got going on?
Yeah. And so for me, I'm going to start doing some more online training for ACL return to sport. I've had people who have come from outside of kind of call it the 10, 15 mile radius of our location in Wilmington, who've had some interest, or they can't afford personal one-on-one training. And so I require anyone who wants to train with me, they have to get regular testing. But to make it more affordable, or because they can't get over here, we can set that up online. And then I'll just redo the program every 3 to 4 weeks based on what the testing does. Doesn't give me the same day-to-day evaluation, but it's a better alternative than flying in the dark. And then in terms of brick and mortar, so we are currently in Wilmington. Obviously, we opened up our physical therapy clinic over here before we moved. And so we are actually opening up a new location in Woburn, hopefully in the next few months, probably this summer at this point. But it's going to be designed a little bit differently and kind of cater into what I've talked about for the last hour. And so open floor plan for both physical therapy and strength and conditioning. And so our strength and conditioning coaches and physical therapists will collaborate on the floor together. And so, you know, more return to sport, more training for athletes through the rehabilitation process. For some of our athletes we lost when we moved from Woburn to Wilmington on the Winchester side of things, they'll be able to see that, but it will be a different setting than what we're used to here at Athletic Evolution. It will be catered more towards the return to sport and the athletes who are coming up with injuries. And so hopefully people will check us out.
Awesome. Well, one of the things that I appreciate out of this conversation is constantly circling back to an objective process. And unfortunately, you know, I wrote an article a bunch of years ago, and you made me think of it. And when one of the things you mentioned of how Adrian Peterson ruined ACL rehab for everybody in the profession, because, you know, he comes back in 9 months and comes a couple yards away from breaking the NFL rushing record. And so what happens then is I see these high school kids. I remember distinctly a kid that was at a high school that I was working with, who was a really good running back, who wanted to come back at 9 months. And I try to explain to him, like, okay, first of all, Adrian Peterson's one of the greatest to ever do it. You're a good high school running back, okay? He has round-the-clock care from some of the best people in the world. You're going to your local PT on the corner next on a treatment table next to an old lady with a frozen shoulder getting free cookie recipes. Like, you're not getting the same care. And so with that, you can't have anywhere near the expectations that he had. And he was way better going in. And so with that, like, you know, having that better appreciation and having some objective data that says this is kind of where you're at and this is where you need to get to takes a lot of that out, a lot of those false expectations. And also because, as you mentioned, there's a huge psychological component to any traumatic injury at this level. And so, you know, I appreciate that you kind of touched on all aspects of that.
Yeah. Well, I just say lastly, you know, don't, as a coach, whether you're going to return to sport or ever, don't be afraid to test your athletes. It will humble you several times. I've had several clients where, oh, we're doing all the right things and I did this before and it worked and we do this and then we test and it doesn't. And so you can either just do the same thing and beat your head against the wall and not get better and do a disservice to you, or you can level up and find out why and research it and talk to some people, try some different things and retest. And if it works, right, you've solved some problems and got better as a coach and got better as whatever you're doing. And so I'd recommend, you know, I didn't test enough with my healthy athletes, and return to sport has led me to start testing more and more with my healthy athletes so I can hold those programming and myself accountable as well. And so I'd recommend that to any coach.
Fantastic. It's kind of like, what was Gray's old line, Mike? Don't trust me, test me first. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Great stuff. Well, certainly appreciate your time, Mike. Anything, last thoughts that you want to wrap up with?
Nah, Scott, it's always good to see you. And, you know, congratulations on your continued success, and I look forward to seeing you in the future, man.
Thank you very much. Good chatting with you, Mike.
Awesome. Appreciate your time. Thank you, Scott. Nice, and thank you, Eric, for listening. And this has been the Principles of Performance podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Principles of Performance podcast. If you've enjoyed our content, please like and share on your social media outlets, as well as subscribe and give us a review on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred platform is to listen to. For more information on the Principles of Program Design courses and workshops, visit us at www.principlesofprogramdesign.com and follow us on all of the social media channels where we post new content every day. To save 10% on any PPD courses, enter the discount code PRINCIPLESPODCAST10 at checkout. If you have any questions we can answer or suggestions for the show, you can email us at info@principlesofprogramdesign.com or message us on social media. Thank you again for your support.